Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.
The word division is inconsistent with the word unanimous. And verdicts have to be unanimous in federal court.
But in the New England Compounding Center case, the verdicts were not unanimous, but no mistrial was called. We'll find out why. Also today, reaction from the Cape on the Trump administration's decision to put the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission on hold.
All of us on the commission were surprised, probably shocked. We had not encountered this before.
Plus, we'll talk to the Mystic Valley Charter students who were being disciplined for wearing extensions in their hair.
Taken off the track team, taken off the softball team, off their Latin club. They can no longer go to the sports banquet, and she can no longer go to prom. There's nothing wrong with their hair. Their hair is beautiful.
That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
They actually recorded numbers, literally recording their votes. It's an extraordinary verdict form. It's like nothing I've ever seen.
That's David Schumacher, former assistant U.S. attorney, talking about the verdict form handed in by jurors in the case of Barry Cadden, the Massachusetts compounding pharmacist at the center of the deadly outbreak of fungal meningitis that infected hundreds and killed at least 60 people. Now, you'll remember that back in March, a jury convicted Cadden of racketeering and mail fraud. The jury found him not guilty of the most serious charge, second-degree murder. But closer examination of the jury verdict form shows that the jury may not have been unanimous in their verdicts, even though that's what federal court requires. It's an unprecedented event, eliciting reactions from the legal community like the one you heard from Attorney Schumacher. WBUR's David Bowery reported this story, and he joins us now. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So the jurors weren't unanimous in the Cadden verdict? I mean, what's going on? What was actually on that form?
Well, they certainly don't look like they were unanimous, and that's the proof. You look at that verdict form, that extraordinary verdict form, because when you see it, you see they put numbers down, and all the numbers add up to 12, as in the number of jurors, but they're split on the not guilty finding. So there's the evidence that, in fact, they're not unanimous.
Huh, interesting. So, I mean, basically all the jurors had to do is there's columns, right? Guilty or not guilty for every count. And all they had to do is check it. But instead they put these numbers as well, right?
Right. Well, and this is what is extraordinary. Nobody has seen this before, where the jurors actually put the numbers voting for guilty or for not guilty. So what's telling is that when they convicted Cadden, and they convicted him on 57 counts, they put a little legend in, handwritten at the bottom of each page where they find him guilty, checkmark equals unanimous. There's no such thing for the not guilty counts. There's a little check beside the not guilty, and then there are the numbers that indicate, in fact, they're not unanimous.
Okay. Now, I should note that people can take a look at the jury form for themselves because we've got images of them at our website, radioboston.org. And really, I encourage people to go there because it's a thing to behold. Now, David, I mean, as we said at the beginning of this conversation, federal courts require unanimous verdicts. So how could the judge have allowed this to happen?
That's a good question. How could he have? You know, I'm not the judge in this. I'm not the judge. How could he have let it happen? Well, it is extraordinary. And there's so many things people have never seen before. And one of them is to imagine you're in the courtroom, Meghna, and understand that as the clerk is reading the verdict forms, nobody else, certainly not the lawyers, can see what she's reading. So all they hear are the verdicts, guilty and not guilty. They're surprised that, in fact, he was found not guilty on those 25 predicate acts of second-degree murder, but they don't see it. And they don't see the verdict form until the jurors have actually left the courthouse. Uh-huh. And so here it is. The diva has sung. It's over. Done. You can't bring it back. And they look at that form and they say, wait a minute. they weren't unanimous. And if they weren't unanimous, they hadn't reached any verdict at all, technically, Meghna.
Right. So you spoke with former federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner for some perspective. And again, she sat on the federal bench, and here's what she said.
The question is, what's the significance of these numbers? I know what would have happened in my courtroom if I saw these numbers. I would have had a sidebar, that is to say, a confidential discussion with the lawyers and say, what do you want me to do with this?
Well, that's former judge, federal judge Nancy Gertner. I mean, David, we know that that sidebar didn't happen in this case, but have the lawyers for either side spoken up? Is anyone calling for a retrial? Could they even do that?
There seems to be no precedent for this happening, Meghna. So the appeals it seems like it's out of the question. It's done. As soon as those jurors leave, it's over. And Barry Cadden has, you know, this is the whole rule of double jeopardy. He cannot be retried for the crimes that he was charged with and he was found not guilty of. And, you know, this is part of that extraordinary scene that took place because the judge says before he looks over the verdict slip and turns it over to the clerk to read out loud to the court, he says that every juror is going to be questioned at the end to make sure that their verdict was unanimous. He doesn't do that, but you have what is sort of seems like the afterwards, it seems like the kabuki dance here, where the clerk says, so say you, Mr. Foreman. Yes, so say you, members of the jury. Yes. But of course, they would say yes because they'd already reported, and one would say incorrectly, that they were unanimous. So what they were affirming by saying yes, according to some lawyers, was that they were unanimously confused about the need to be unanimous.
Wow. So let me see if I have this straight now, David. I mean, what we have here is a case in which, in fact, on many of the counts, it was a hung jury. But because that wasn't raised before the verdicts were announced, that the verdict, and since the jury has gone home, those verdicts currently stand. No mistrial being declared or anything. But, I mean, it just boggles the mind. I mean,
It really is sui generis for this reporter and for everybody in that courthouse. They've not seen it before. Stephen Gillers, a professor at New York University, says the judge had an obligation. He did exactly the opposite of what Nancy had said she would do as a federal judge. But the ramifications of what he did are enormous because if, in fact, the jurors are not unanimous, they've not reached any verdict at all. They should have been ordered, sent back to deliberate, but they weren't. And had they gone through deliberations, remember, some of those votes were very close to find Barry Cadden guilty of the second-degree murders.
Right.
But had they continued, and had they not gotten there, they might have, but had they not gotten there, they then would have been considered hung. The judge would have declared a mistrial, but in the case of a mistrial, the government has the chance to retry the defendant on those particular charges. So by accepting the not guilty verdicts, Judge Richard Stearns basically enabled a process to stop deliberations and to find Barry Cadden not guilty, one would say, before the jury finished its deliberations.
Wow, David. Okay, that's something to say. Now, but because of the way the law works, Cadden can't be retried on these things. There's double jeopardy here, right? But can this have an effect on any subsequent next steps in his case?
Well, he comes up for sentencing next month. Now, there's another oddity about federal sentencing, that even though he's been found not guilty of second-degree murders, when you get to sentencing, the standard is no longer beyond a reasonable doubt, but preponderance of evidence. So what I'm telling you, sit down here, Meghna, is that the federal court can use his acquitted behavior to argue that he should be sentenced for the same maximum penalty if he had been convicted of the murders, which he wasn't.
Huh.
So they may well seek life in prison, which is what he would have faced had he been found guilty of those second-degree murder charges.
Interesting. So possibly an explanation there for why the prosecution isn't seeking, well, they can't even seek the mistrial now. But
the defense obviously did not want to question this.
Uh-huh.
You know, the prosecution won 57 convictions. They won guilty on 57 counts. And prosecutors are generally trained not to ask for a poll of the jurors when, in fact, they've won all these convictions. So they didn't call for a poll of the jurors. But, you know, it would have taken, what's extraordinary is that people have told me it would have taken 15 minutes for the judge to have sorted all this out and to find out that the jurors were confused or didn't understand their instructions, that they needed to be 12 to nothing, up or down, guilty or not guilty. And that's what appears happened.
Well, David, Glenn Chin, who was the New England Compounding Center supervisory pharmacist, he faces trial as well. There's no date yet set for that trial, but he's been charged with numerous counts of second degree murder. Makes me wonder how what happened with the jury in the Cadden case might have an impact on Chin's trial.
Yeah, it's hard to say. We'd only be speculating. But in fact, the most severe penalty in Chin's case, like in Cadden's case before him, would be being found guilty of those second degree murders. And, you know, this is, it's extraordinary to look at what's happened here. Now, the only people who know, Magda, the only people who know what those numbers meant, those guilty, not guilty, that were called unanimous, are the jurors themselves. And Richard Stearns, the judge, is holding on to the jury list about two months afterwards, after the trial. Federal rulings in the courthouse in Boston say that jury lists are public. They're presumed to be public unless there are exceptional circumstances the judge offers for holding them. Yeah. This judge has not offered any exceptional circumstances. He's still holding to the jury lists. So like Richard Stearns, we haven't been able to question the jurors.
David, all of this makes me wonder if in future cases in Boston Federal Court, we're going to see lawyers who don't like the verdict saying, let me see that jury slip before the case is gaveled to a close.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So some people are critical of the prosecutors here, saying they should have asked for a sidebar right away because Stearns signaled that something was amiss when he told the clerk, read the verdicts, not the numbers. Well, what?
Yeah.
And so that would sort of catch your attention. But as one of the prosecutors, as some of the people in the court have said, nobody in a million years would think that the judge would actually accept non-unanimous verdicts
right.
as unanimous. So nobody thought of stepping up and questioning it. But that's what people in the court say. Look, you can't blame the jurors. Nobody would have ever thought that that might happen. Nobody knows that it ever happened before.
Yeah. That's WBUR senior reporter David Boeri. David, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Magda.
All right, let's shift gears here now and talk about electronic medical records, or EMRs. They're back in the news because of that global malware attack that hit many hospitals late last week. The malware, called WannaCry, revealed fundamental vulnerabilities in many EMR systems. But if you asked many Massachusetts doctors, they'd probably tell you that they've long had even deeper concerns about electronic medical records, mainly that they can put data collection over actual doctoring. Well, that's how I put it after I read a recent Common Health post. Carrie Goldberg is host of WBR's Common Health blog, and she's here to tell us more. Hi there, Carrie.
Hey, Magna. And yes, this WannaCry ransomware is causing lots of problems right now, but please forgive me for this one. Clunky electronic medical records have been making doctors and nurses WannaCry for years now.
Okay.
Sorry.
You know I love a good pun. As much as anyone else, but on a more serious note, what are the doctor's concerns?
Well, so here's one of the most powerful lines in this Common Health post on the topic that went really viral this weekend. It was written by three leading Boston-based doctors, and they write, EMRs were supposed to improve the quality, safety, and efficiency of healthcare and provide instant access to vital patient information. Instead, EMRs have become the bane of doctors and nurses everywhere. They are the medical equivalent of texting while driving, sucking the soul out of the practice of medicine while failing to improve care.
So they are not mincing their words here.
They are not. Now, Meghna, we've all probably had the experience by now of talking to a doctor who's checking boxes and working on some sort of computer as part of our visit, right?
Yeah. In fact, my doctor and also my kid's pediatrician, they use a person, a scribe, to do that.
Yeah. So one of the commenters on this Common Health post included a sample dialogue of what it's like to work with a bad electronic medical record system. And I thought you and I might act it out to give okay. listeners a sense. Okay. So you be the patient. I'll be the medical assistant who's using or trying to use the system. Okay. Here we go.
Okay.
Meghna, why are you here?
I need refills on my medications. I ran out months ago, but, you know, life, I haven't been able to get in before now, and they won't authorize a refill by phone because my primary care doctor left the practice.
Okay, I'm looking at my computer, not at you. So are you still taking, simvastatin to lower your cholesterol?
No, I ran out months ago, and I need a new prescription to refill it.
Okay, so I'm looking at a box, and I'm clicking it, click, click. Okay, are you still taking lisinopril to lower your blood pressure?
No, like I said, I ran out months ago. I am here because I need to get the refill.
Okay, click, click, click. I'm looking at the box. Okay, are you still taking the triptan for your migraines?
I'm going to need one after this appointment, but I don't have any left. My refills ran out.
Okay, so is that a no?
Right. I am not taking it now because I do not have any refills left.
Okay, so then I click no, and I leave the room, and now the doctor arrives. So now I'm being the doctor. Meghna, why are you here today?
And I am holding my hands up against my temples. I am completely out of refills on all my medications, doctor. I need new prescriptions for the refill.
Okay, I'm looking at the screen, not you. What medications are you talking about? I don't see that you are currently taking any medications.
Okay, Carrie, I get it. Okay. Even just the role playing. It's fake, but it's driving me crazy.
Yeah.
All right. So I see the problem.
It's
but about electronic medical records, I mean, we should point out that they exist for good reasons. There's
yes.
a 2009 federal law that pushed EMRs because, honestly, it's just ridiculous to rely on paper in the 21st century. And that, you know,
right.
that the EMRs, they've created a whole other industry around them.
And there's no villains here.
There's
really.
No villains here.
Right.
But apparently the doctors in your post, in the Common Health post, said it's, again, sucking the soul out of medicine and failing to improve the quality of care.
Right. So they're arguing that these systems are often bad for care because good diagnosis and treatment means listening to patients with undivided attention and not scrolling through endless multiple choice questions where you check off answers in boxes. One of the editorial's authors, Dr. Vikas Saini, he's the president of the Lowen Institute. He describes this really hard emotional landscape among many doctors and other healthcare staffers who spend their days looking at screens instead of patients.
Their emotions are really one of either quiet rage or just bleak resignation or just a general sense that you know, this is not what they went into medicine to do, and a real sense of almost betrayal or loss of meaning.
So I don't know about you, but I do not want my doctors and nurses full of quiet rage.
No. And that's a serious response.
Yeah, it's powerful.
Okay,
yeah.
But Carrie, the genie is out of the bottle on this,
mm-hmm.
though. I mean,
yep.
some of the biggest hospitals in Boston have been shifting to new electronic medical record systems. And just to be clear, nobody's advocating for a return to paper, right?
No. No one's saying go back to paper. And the doctors who wrote this post aren't arguing for that at all. Here's Dr. John Levinson. He's a Massachusetts General Hospital cardiologist and IT expert, by the way. And he co-authored this Common Health piece. And he was an early adopter of electronic medical records.
In my view, computing is absolutely key to the future of healthcare. But what we are doing now is not medical computing. And the systems that are being forced on physicians to use in 2017 are not electronic medical records. They are management tools which interfere with medical care.
and management tools, by the way, particularly for billing, among other things.
Okay, but about this point that's come up a couple times about it interferes with medical care. I mean, on the other hand, electronic medical records were supposed to do things like better record portability
yep.
from office to hospital, increased safety. They're supposed to be lead to improvements in the totality of care, regardless of who your doctor is. And an ideal world is supposed to save money, too, in the
Ideally.
Long run, right?
Yep.
So
yep.
Maybe these things will all happen someday. But for now, I mean, what are doctors suggesting be done?
Well, so the three doctors who wrote this editorial, they also include Dr. Bruce Price, who's the chief of neurology at McLean Hospital. They're issuing kind of a call to action that there be town meetings and public discussions about how problematic these systems are and how to make them better. And in particular, how to change the 2009 federal law that you mentioned that has created or contributed to these problems. So here's Dr. Saini again.
When large healthcare organizations like we have in this town spend billions of dollars for this kind of a product, that's really scandalous, especially when the end user has the experience that they're having.
So I asked him what we can do as patients.
I'm not sure what patients can do on their own, certainly not in isolation, although I've heard from that a few fairly large donors have been asking what they can do, which is a nice gesture. But the reality is, I think we have to band together.
And Meghna, Dr. Saini is the co-chair of the Right Care Alliance, a new national movement of activists working inside healthcare and with patients to put on pressure and to find ways to solve big, messy problems like this in our healthcare system.
Absolutely. No shortage of such problems.
Afraid not.
But I keep coming back to the soul-crushing nature of this and the impact it can have on actual care.
Well,
yes,
most important.
Carrie Goldberg, host of WBUR's Common Health blog. You can find a link to the post, Death by a Thousand Clicks, at our website, radioboston.org. Carrie, thank you.
Welcome.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Folks on Cape Cod are still trying to understand why late last week the Trump administration ordered a halt to meetings of the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission. That's the local group that advises the federal government on how to best manage the National Seashore. Joining us now from Provincetown is Richard Delaney. He's chairman of the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission. He's served on it since the 1980s. Richard, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, give us your reaction or how you felt when you found out that the Trump administration had moved to halt meetings on the commission.
Well, I think all of us on the commission were surprised, probably shocked. We had not encountered this before, and we had a meeting planned for today. Our official meeting, as had been advertised, was to start at 1 o'clock this afternoon. And we just learned literally last week that that was not to be.
Hmm. And why does this matter? I mean, what exactly does the commission do that's so important for the administration of the seashore?
Well, we are its official advisory board, and we represent literally four levels of government, local, county, state, and federal government. And that provides a really wonderful forum for collaboration and communication. And the reason that's important is because this particular seashore park, Cape Cod National Seashore, was established as a kind of an overlay to existing towns. They were here much before at the park. Unlike a western park, we have open lands and it's owned by the federal government and they have a national park. This was one that was overlaid with town property and county property and state interests. So initially, there was a fair amount of resistance from locals saying we don't need a federal agency running a show or running a program in our town. So the reason we created an advisory commission is to provide that forum to have a way to work out tensions
right.
between the levels of government.
I mean, to put it more bluntly, there was a lot of bad blood between towns and the federal government when the National Seashore was created because a lot of land was seized, some through eminent domain. I mean, folks may not remember or may not think of that when they when they walk the beach on the Cape these days. But that, Richard, made me want to ask you, I mean, to me, that's one of the reasons why the Trump administration's move is quite surprising, because here we have an example of how local towns, local people are given a voice through the advisory process, through the commission's process in the administration of, you know, a federal park, a federal reserve. So one would think that that's something that the Trump administration would support.
Precisely. Yeah, precisely. There were incredible tensions and controversy when the park was established. Of course, nowadays, even some of those naysayers who are still around look back and say, boy, it was a darn good thing we created this, because the alternative would have been a horror show. So most people believe in the park, most people understand it, but yet there are still these intergovernmental tensions, which are natural. We've been very, I think, helpful resolving many of them. Our advice to the superintendent is almost always accepted and implemented. And you're right, this is an example of government working. Even to put it on hold temporarily, I don't see the wisdom. None of us see the wisdom of that.
The Interior Department has provided some reaction to the concern that's been raised out on the Cape about this move. Heather Swift, a spokeswoman for the Interior Department, has said that this is not, quote, an attempt to weaken local voices. This administration prioritizes local communities over special interests and bureaucrats, and that the review is aimed at improving the process. Are you convinced by that?
Time will tell.
Mm. Well, so what effect might this temporary hold have on how the seashore is administered?
Well, if this becomes permanent, the superintendent will have to lapse back to one-on-one conversations if some project that he or she is about to undertake or a management decision. They'll have to go to individual towns one by one. I think there'll be less communication. There'll be less coordination. It's probably not the end of the world. The park will go on. It will still manage its affairs. But I think those tensions from back in the beginning will start to percolate again.
Oh, interesting. Now, can you give me an example of a time or two when the advisory commission has actually made recommendations to the administrator of the National Seashore that ended up working out? Like, give me an example of how that relationship has worked.
Well, one of the early ones that was very contentious was whether or not off-road vehicles would be allowed to continue using the beaches pretty much freely as they had done prior to the park's establishment. And that was a really hard one. We set up sort of a negotiated process. We used the advisory commission as an independent forum, and we basically all came up with a consensus around when and where, what part of the year, and what parts of the seashore would be open to off-road vehicles. It worked out beautifully. Again, there were a lot of controversy around it, but it worked out. We also had an issue where 10 years ago, there was a great push to have jet skis operating in every water body in the bays and harbors and off the National Seashore. They were deemed to be a negative impact to the environment and contrary to the mission of the park to preserve, you know, the peace and quiet natural resources. We, after negotiations and discussions, recommended banning them almost totally. The superintendent accepted that. And so far, that has worked out well.
Right. Well, that same Interior Department spokeswoman, Heather Swift, also said that, quote, the secretary is committed to restoring trust in the department's decision making, and that begins with institutionalizing state and local input and ongoing collaboration, particularly in communities surrounding public lands. I'm just wondering, what do you make of that?
Well, I didn't realize that we had lost any trust among ourselves here on the Cape. I'm happy to give them a little bit of the benefit of the doubt if, in fact, they are and they feel they do need to evaluate this and other. I believe they said there are 200 other advisory commissions or similar bodies throughout the National Park Service and the Department of Interior. I don't know how the rest of them are operating, but it certainly doesn't apply to us. But I'm also a little bit mystified that they have to put everything on hold while they do this. They could certainly take a look at how things are operating without having to stop progress, especially, you know, in places where it's working. So my concern has been that I know the overall policies that are coming out of the White House, at least, are attempts to open up national parks, U.S. forests, sanctuary areas to more exploitation of the natural resources by commercial interests. And President Trump and his team have said repeatedly, and it's part of their platform, they would like to go into these national parks, particularly in the West, to drill for oil, to do more forest harvesting. And I would think that if there was resistance from the advisory commissions out there, that would not help them implement that policy. So my cautionary side says this could be an attempt to reduce the ability for the public to participate in those discussions about changes in policies.
Well, Richard Delaney is chairman of the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission. Richard, thank you so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. At the Mystic Valley Regional Charter School, the school's dress code has turned into a debate over education and civil rights. Students at the school face detention, even suspension, if they wear extensions in their hair. And some parents say that policy is racist. Now, we contacted the school and asked them if they'd join us in this conversation today. They declined and referred us instead to a letter sent to parents that says the dress code is designed to, quote, permit students to focus their attentions on academics and reduces visible gaps between those of different means. Multiple civil rights groups, however, are weighing in, including the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice. They've demanded public records from Mystic Valley Regional Charter School to assess the impact of the school's dress code on students of color. Joining us now are two of those students, Deanna and Maya Cook. They're 15-year-old, and they join us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi.
Also with us is their mom, Colleen Cook. Colleen, welcome to you.
Thank you.
And on the line is Kim Janey, Senior Project Director for the Massachusetts Advocate for Children. Kim Janey, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
Kim, I'll come back to you in a couple of minutes, but I want to give Deanna and Maya a chance to tell us their story here. So this has gotten a lot of attention around the country and even around the world. Can you just tell us exactly what happened to you at Mystic Valley Regional Charter School about your hair?
Yeah. So our hair, it was, we got extensions in them because we wanted to get them braided, and that's what Black African-American people do when they braid their hair. They just put extensions in it to protect it and to help it grow. And when we showed up to school, the first day we went, it was fine. No one said anything. And the second day, they told us that we had to take them out.
And did they say, who told you that, first of all? Teachers, administrators?
Yeah, a teacher and the nurse.
Okay. And did they say why?
They just said because we couldn't have extensions.
It violates the dress code.
Okay. And then what happened after that?
Well, we brought the letter home to our parents and we told them that we didn't think that was very fair because that's where we're supposed to have extensions in our hair, and asking us to take them out would be going against what we're supposed to do and what our culture is.
Mm-hmm. And we had till Monday to take them out, too.
Okay. And so they gave you a couple of days?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. And, I mean, you've got them in now, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So you didn't take them out. And,
no.
And then what happened?
Well, we kept getting detentions and letters sent home, and the school kept just giving us more detentions and infractions for it.
Yeah, and we kept on, like, as we kept them in day after day, we were in more and more violation of the dress code and their policy.
Okay. Now, I've also, well, actually, Colleen, let me pull you in here. When Deanna and Maya told you this happened and the school contacted you, what was your thought?
We met with the school a couple times, and we asked them, how do we go about talking and having a conversation to change the policy? And they basically said that they felt this was an equitable policy and they weren't going to change it. And that's when we sent a certified letter to the Board of Trustees asking for discipline to be paused and to talk about the policy and how we thought it was not equitable across the board and a discriminatory policy.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's part of the story, help me understand here, that did you witness other students being asked about their hair as well?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, tell me more about that.
Students were called down whether they had braids or not, just if they were, like, most of them or all of them were just Black or African American, and they were called down. Some of them didn't even have braids, and they were asked if their hair was real or not, and some of them were interrogated, where the nurse or whoever was asking them was saying, oh, is that your real hair? Think about it. Think about it before you answer. Think real quick. Do you have your answer? Okay. Is it real or is it not real? Which is interrogation tactics. And most students said it was their real hair, and some students said that it wasn't.
So you know, in the letter that Mystic Valley Regional Charter School sent to parents, they say that the school, this is a quote, unequivocally did not march a group of students to the office.
I would say that the school should look in their records, and their infractions that they sent out should all be dated on the same day. So if they're saying they didn't do that, they can check themselves, because they were all sent down on the same day. And students, they all came, and everyone knows about it because they came and they told them. It was a big thing because they said, oh, I was sent down for my hair. They asked me if it was real or not, and everybody said that was ridiculous. It was crazy.
Okay. Colleen, you know, the school says that there's the reason behind their dress code overall is, as I read earlier, that it really is designed to help students focus their attention on what matters, academics and things like that at school. And more importantly, they want to, again, in the school's words, reduce visible gaps between those of different means, with, you know, pointing to the fact that maybe young girls with extensions or other types of treatments to their hair, it might be a sign of, I don't know, greater, better socioeconomic status, and that can be distracting.
They did not say that to me in my meetings with them. They told me that artificial or unnatural hair was not allowed to be braided in to their hair. So I found it I was very confused that they would now come and say that, because it actually it costs less to have their hair braided, because the braids last for 3 months. So if you have extensions in, it lasts quite a considerable time longer than just regular braids.
Yeah. So let me ask all of you guys a question here, because I was looking at this dress code overall. It's quite lengthy, so I'm not going to read the whole thing, but there are pretty specific rules about not wearing drastic or unnatural hair colors, no shaved lines, shaved sides, extra long hair or hair more than 2 inches in thickness or height is not allowed. No coloring, no dyeing, no lightening, no highlights, no streaking. I mean, there's a lot of rules here. Mm-hmm. You guys have been going to school there for quite a while now, right?
Yeah, 11 years.
And so had you ever run into any of this kind of thing before? I mean, any violations of the dress code before?
Violations of dress code, but not related to hair extensions braided into your hair for protection.
So why do you think this is different? Why did you feel the need to speak out?
Because African Americans and Black people are really the only ones who I've seen wear extensions, and all of my friends have extensions in their hair. They are the ones, you know, Black people, they have them. So when they said no extensions, I was thought, well, only Black people wear extensions, so how would that be fair? Because that not everybody wears them. Mm-hmm.
Well, Kim Janey, with the Massachusetts Advocates for Children, Senior Project Director there, you've been very patient. Thank you very much. React to what you've been hearing here. What do you have concerns?
I have deep concerns, so I was just completely outraged. But first, I would just want to commend Maya and Deanna for standing up. I think you are very brave, and I appreciate you speaking out on this issue.
Thank you.
But it's outrageous. It really is outrageous and quite exhausting. So as a Black woman, that we are still dealing with this issue where our hair is being questioned, that students would be marched to an office to be interrogated about whether their hair is real. That is the real distraction.
Yeah. Mm.
That is taking time away from learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it is discriminatory.
It is.
The bottom
really
line is discriminatory. And, you know, I hope that they will change this policy.
Mm-hmm.
But even if they do, you know, I'm deeply concerned that, you know, you still have a team of educators who believe that the only way Black children can learn is if somehow they be something other than who they are.
So it's Kim Janey, it's discriminatory if it's selectively applied against young women of color here, right? Because, I mean, again, I read through the whole school's dress code, and it seemed like almost anybody, regardless of race or even gender, could be found in violation of the dress code somehow. But don't we have to prove here that this is selectively happening to young women of color?
Well, I would just quote the young students, Maya and Deanna, who, I mean, the girls who are wearing extensions tend to be black girls at the school. Mm-hmm. And it's not that that's exclusive to them, but are they also then asking white students, is your hair dyed?
Yeah.
Which is a very expensive process. You can spend over $100 easily to get your hair dyed. Many people dye their hair. They might add highlights. They might go from brunette to blonde. But I didn't hear any of that.
Yeah.
You know, in fact, what I read in the report in the Globe article was that, in fact, young students who have their hair colored, nothing is happening to them.
Mm. Mm-hmm. So I interrupted you earlier, and I apologize for that. But tell me more about this deeper issue that you were getting to about young people of color, specifically young women of color, and their hair and education, and how there are certain presumptions made about them that get played out in situations like this.
Yeah, I just think that we should be focusing on what is inside someone's head and not what's on top of their head. I think that is the real distraction. And even if they change this policy, and I hope that they do, and I don't want to see any of our young people facing punishment because they want to express themselves or celebrate their culture and their history. But even if they change the policy, you know, there's language in that policy that says if your hair grows 2 inches in height off your head, well, whose hair does that?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well,
that's black people, people of color. Our hair tends to do that.
Mm-hmm. It disproportionately affects children of color.
Yeah. Well, Colleen Cook, let me ask you a question here. The Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice wrote a letter to Mystic Valley Regional Charter School, and in it, they said, denying young black women their opportunity to express their cultural identity will not make your school safer, more orderly, or less distracting. Doing this to high school students at a time when they are learning about self-expression and self-advocacy is particularly troubling. And then they write this, and doing this to a pair of black twin girls who were adopted by white parents and who are exploring their racial identity is profoundly disturbing. Can you comment on that?
It is disturbing. We want to enrich them. We want them to embrace their color. We're proud of them. We're proud of their beautiful black girls. We love them just the way they are. The school was also saying that adding this to their hair, they should feel good about who they are. And it's like, you're saying that they don't feel good about who they are. They absolutely do. This is black hair care.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. So it's a protective hairstyle. And mm-hmm. so there's going to be less heat on your hair in terms of blow drying or maybe pressing your hair. It's a protective hairstyle, and it is a part of our culture.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just, this attack on black hair and what we have had to go through as black girls and black women is really exhausting. I remember being a student, you know, myself in high school, and I went to a predominantly white high school where, you know, other students want to touch your hair. Mm-hmm. And pet you like you're you know, a pet, a dog or a cat.
Yeah. And
that's offensive.
Yeah.
Kim Janey, what next steps would you like to see taken here in order to resolve this issue?
Well, I think the school should definitely follow through and respond to the letter sent by the Lawyers Committee. I think it was a very good letter. I think we need to see the data, the suspension data. To see how this is impacting our students, particularly if it's disproportionately targeting black students. We need to understand that. And I think they have to right that wrong. I think we need more diversity in the school in terms of the educators. So, you know, I read that there's one black teacher.
Right.
Even though the school is 40% students of color, that's
yeah.
problematic. That's how you end up with policies like this.
One black teacher on a staff of about 170.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think that is important to be addressed. I know folks are now interested in attending, you know, the next board meeting at DESE because mm-hmm. of this issue.
Yeah.
I mean, this is huge.
Colleen Cook, same question to you. I mean, these are your kids. Well, what would you like to, how would you like to see this get resolved?
White men and white women should not be trying to make a policy for black girls' hair. There should be input from the community. There should be input from fellow black people. This is a black issue, and I'm even learning every day. I don't know everything, but I've learned. I have braided their hair. I have sat down with them. I know their products, but I learn every day. And so I look to the community to figure out their hair. And as women, we all have bad hair days, and we all, you know, fight with our hair. And it's an issue that's very complex mm-hmm. to the black community, especially the girls.
Yeah,
exactly.
And we've just got a couple seconds left. So mm-hmm. Maya and Deanna, last thought goes to you. I'm going to ask you the question I asked the adults here. What do you want? What are the next steps you want?
I would like to see the policy removed or revised to have, you know, to be for black people instead of against them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, think about our hair and how it needs to be maintained instead of taking away what we need to do to maintain
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Well, I should once again underscore that we did invite Mystic Valley Regional Charter School to participate in this conversation. They did decline. But Maya and Deanna Cook, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
And yes, Colleen Cook, my thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And Kim Janey, Senior Project Director for the Massachusetts Advocate for Children, thank you as well for joining us.
Thank you for including me, and thank you, girls, for your advocacy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We will be keeping our eye on this story as it develops and see what happens. But to round out the show today, we want to end on another but different note of inspiration. And that inspiration comes from the legendary Lionel Richie. The Motown star was in town at the Berklee College of Music on Saturday. He received an honorary doctorate at commencement ceremonies held there. Richie, of course, is a best-selling solo artist and former member of the funk soul group The Commodores. Between 1981 and 1987, Richie had 13 consecutive top 10 singles. He also won 4 Grammys, an Oscar, and a Golden Globe. But as Lionel Richie told Berklee grads, when he was a young man, going into music wasn't expected nor entirely welcomed by his family.
I sat there with my father and mother and grandmother, and I tried to explain to them that I'm going to venture out of the academic side of the Richie family and step into the world of music. We were going to be the Black Beatles, the Commodores. We were going to take over the world. I can't use the words my dad said to me at that moment, but he was clear that I was one damn fool in the family. And then 5 years passed, and one hit record, 5 hit records, 10 hit records. And Barbara Walters was interviewing my father. And he said, "Mr. Richie, what do you think about your son?" He said, "I think it is the job of every parent to stand firmly behind the child in his endeavors." Which means your parents can be paid off.
All it takes is multiple hit records. But on a more serious note, Lionel Richie gave Berklee students heartfelt encouragement to really pursue their dreams and to do so with humility. Because, as Richie said, you never know how much your music can change lives. It's a lesson that Richie said he learned in 1990.
Nelson Mandela had just come out of prison. And we had a group of us to bring him to New York and to L.A. And there were lines of people waiting to meet Madiba. And I remember he caught my eye I was in the back of the room, and he walked over to me, broke the line, walked over to me, and he said, "Young man, I want to thank you for all the lyrics you've written, because your words got me through many days in prison." And it was at that point in my life I realized I had no words, just tears. I broke down on his shoulder. I realized that I was holding my father. I was holding the struggles of a nation and a world and a culture. And I made a difference.
Lionel Richie speaking at the Berklee College of Music commencement ceremony on Saturday. He received an honorary doctorate of music. Seems to me, girl, you know I've done all I can. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Yeah. Ooh, that's why I'm easy. I'm easy like Sunday morning. Yeah. That's why I'm easy.